Our third case for this morning is Velazquez-Garcia against Holder, 1326-10. And we will begin by hearing, when he's ready, from Mr. Khalil.
Good morning, Your Honors. I am Khalil J. Khalil, and I represent the petitioner appellant in this matter, Jorge Velazquez-Garcia. The large issue in this case is simply whether or not the matter of Velazquez, decided by an agency, was an error.
Now, do you see this as a Chevron Step 2 case or something different? My obvious concern is, and as the government spells out in its brief, is the degree to which this court is free to disagree with the interpretation of the phrase sought to acquire given by the board in the Velazquez case.
I would rather think this is a Chevron Step 1 case, Your Honor.
How can you say it's unambiguous?
Sought to acquire.
Well, but
okay. How does that apply to somebody trying to earn money to pay a lawyer to apply? Is that seeking to acquire?
I don't think that would be.
Why not?
Well,
or how about consulting a lawyer?
No, I don't think that would be sought to acquire. I believe sought to acquire, like I indicated in my brief, would be some sort of action that demarcates the alien's case for eventual adjudication.
I don't know what that means. Well, demarcates a case for eventual adjudication.
I don't believe Congress used benchmark terms such as file, apply, purposely. What I believe it means, sought to acquire, is the alien wanted to go forward with adjusting his status. So,
okay, desire is not enough. I'm giving you a hard time because I'm agreeing with what was implicit in Judge Wood's question, which this doesn't seem at all transparent as applied to a variety of factual circumstances. And that would suggest that this is a Chevron Step 2 case.
Well, I would take it a step back, and I would say that what the petitioner in this case did, not simply hired an attorney. He retained an attorney. The attorney filed an appearance, which was myself. The attorney filed a request, an investigative request, with one of the adjudicating agencies, which was USCIS.
Your FOIA request you're talking about?
FOIA request, Your Honor. And the purpose of that FOIA request was to figure out whether he was eligible for adjustment of status under 1255I, 245I.
So here's my issue with this. You know, I can certainly appreciate the idea that the phrase sought to acquire is a more capacious phrase than file or make an application or any number of other things. But I'm quite uncomfortable, and I think this is maybe implicit in what Judge Hamilton was saying, I'm quite uncomfortable with the idea that you can sit there at your home and privately develop an interest in following up with something, but the immigration authorities, whether it's at DHS or whether it's with the EOIR or wherever it may be, they don't have any idea what you're thinking about. You know, there needs to be some pretty clear external manifestation to them that this is the road you're taking. So that, I think that's why in Velazquez, the board said, you know, it doesn't have to be a perfect application. If there are technical flaws, that's okay. If there's an absence of a signature, if there are extraordinary circumstances. I don't even know if the list in Velazquez was intended to be exclusive. If it's just examples, maybe there are other things that you would fit under. But that's a very different kind of argument. That would be an argument where you're saying we meet Velazquez, not Velazquez is wrong. But I'm very worried that a private intention, or even your FOIA request, people file FOIA requests for all sorts of reasons. I don't know that that's enough of a tip-off to the immigration authorities that he's following up with the change of status.
There was a third action that he did in this case, which
so what
was...
what else does he do? I mean, what are his... how does he signal to the immigration people that he's trying to take advantage of his father's form I-130s.
The attorney also filed an appearance when he was placed in removal proceedings. Within that one-year period, an appearance was filed on February 15, 2012, for his bond proceedings. He was put into the stream of removal proceedings, and we requested bond, which happened to occur after March 1, 2012, within that one-year window.
But just to play the devil's advocate, people resist removal for lots of reasons. And, you know, maybe they say, I'm not an aggravated felon, or maybe they say, actually, I'm really a U.S. citizen, or they say all kinds of things. What is it that alerts the government that, in fact, what he's trying to do is follow up on the I-130?
Judge, we can take the substantial step like Tovar in the 11th Circuit. Tovar based its decision on three unpublished board decisions.
Now, predated
Ovasquez, because we believe that the government, DHS, was interpreting it more broadly. At least the board was.
Yeah.
Well, they seem to have been. Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, they also, Ovasquez stated that Tovar was incorrect because Tovar didn't cite to any unpublished decisions that define sought to acquire more restrictively, which was not the case of the section we're talking about, 1153H1A. Now, the one unpublished decision that the government does cite is a matter of, I believe, Cheryl Tan Fernandez. Yes, that was an unpublished decision. Yes, it talked about the Child Status Protection Act.
Okay, but then the problem is...
Yes,
the problem is all of that... You know, we have these unpublished opinions coming out with kind of an array of standards being applied. The 11th Circuit makes a reasonable decision in Tovar, given the materials they have to work with. And then the board issues Ovasquez, published precedential opinion. That's the kind of thing we have to give Chevron deference to.
As long as the term is ambiguous to get to Chevron step two. And I'm...
So are you admitting that if we actually decide that we go to step two, that there's just no way you can prevail? I mean, you're really kind of stuck here on acquire isn't ambiguous.
I also believe that even Chevron step two...
Maybe you should explore that for a minute.
Thank you. So if we were to assume that it is ambiguous and the government is correct and the board was entitled to interpret it in a reasonable manner, I think it was not a reasonable interpretation. Why? Well, the board jumps to ambiguity immediately and says that we're taking this within context, which they don't. There isn't any citation to the congressional record, and the congressional record was very large, that this case, that this portion of the CSPA was intended to be ameliorative. It was supposed to, like this court said in Eberle-Lidze, I believe, that the CSPA was broad to allow as many parties as practicable to benefit from the CSPA.
So where in Chevron jurisprudence does it say that the responsible agency has to dig that far into the legislative history of a statute?
I would imagine that if you start with a statute that you feel is ambiguous, you would go to congressional intent. That's what I would think.
Well, in a different perspective on congressional intent here, though, is that the CSPA was intended to protect aliens in your client's situation from administrative delays, from the catch-22 that we took so long, we, the agency, took so long to decide your case that you've aged out.
And yeah,
that obviously was perverse, and Congress stepped in and fixed it.
Okay,
But the issue really has to do with the responsibility of the alien to take action within that one-year period.
Okay. So we go to Chevron step two. Did he or did he not seek to acquire within that 1 year? Now, I still believe matter of Ovasquez was unreasonable because, besides the congressional intent, there's a big flaw here. The board is just consumed with nomenclature reconciliation. And that DHS uses the word file generally, DOS uses the term submit.
And Ovasquez's board had the 11th Circuit opinion when it was decided, right?
Definitely.
And so if you look at whether the board was trying to make a reasonable conclusion, it has to weigh on the one side just a whole panoply of actions that could be sought after. Contacting you at the law firm, sending an email, meeting with you in a coffee shop, whatever it may be, all of those different actions, what would be the next substantial step? And then instead say, we're going to make it a bright line, file a petition, but we're going to recognize that this is confusing and difficult, so you might not get it right, so we're going to give you a few exceptions. How is that not a reasonable interpretation by the board? Even if we thought we wanted to make it broader, how under Chevron would that not be a reasonable interpretation?
Well, I believe they keep going back to this reconciliation. They didn't need to. Congress could have used file. They could have used submit. They could have used make an application, which was reconciliatory with both agencies. They've used it in other parts of the INA and also the Child Status Protection Act. So my take is, they could have used that, but they didn't. They purposely didn't want to use it. They wanted it over-encompassed. They wanted it sought to acquire. They wanted it more than just benchmark, hey, file, submit, apply. That's why the board was wrong on Ovasquez, Your Honor.
Does the fact that Ovasquez came down after he sought legal advice have any impact on our analysis?
Well, that goes to our to our case in particular, Your Honor. So I would say that he was on the verge of having an adjustment of status hearing, as the court had ordered on May 17, 2012, to file his any and all relief, including his application for adjustment of status, which he did on May 10, 2012. Ovasquez came out in June of 2012. So that foreclosed the immigration judge from allowing him to hear the adjustment of status application with the 212H waiver for the cannabis conviction. So,
And it was the same lawyer that he sought in March that dealt with that, as well as with the once he was arrested and was dealing with his issues at the arrest?
Well, I represented him at the IJ level and also at the FOIA level, at the agency level, but I didn't represent him in criminal proceedings in 2007, Your Honor. So I knew he would be mandatorily detained.
Okay.
That's why we filed our bond motion to have things move along quicker, because removal proceedings take a long time.
If you'd like to save a minute for rebuttal,
yes,
that would be fine. It's Ms. Melnick.
Good morning. May it please the court. Karen Melnick for the Attorney General of the United States. As Your Honor, Judge Wood pointed out, it is the government's position that the phrase sought to inquire is ambiguous. But under any standard, petitioner can't reach his own unworkable standard.
I'm not so sure of that. I mean, when I look at sought to acquire and compare it with other things in the immigration laws, without bothering to get to the congressional record or anything else, it looks to me like Congress chose a deliberately broad standard that, you know, you are trying to follow up on this I-130 application. And of course, the Immigration Service didn't cover itself in glory in Mr. Velazquez's situation anyway, since it seems to have lost his father's original form I-130, and had it not lost that, everything, we probably wouldn't be here.
I believe that was abandoned. There was a request.
That's what they said, but it seems actually that, well, he's not told the right information when he first tries to find out what's out there. The fact that there are two applications isn't accurately reported. So it's a troublesome thing. But just on the sought to acquire, Ovasquez may be correct in the sense of, or a permissible interpretation in the sense that it's not a legal term of art, that the statute may also be satisfied, as the board says, by other actions that fall short of filing. And it seems to me we may really be in a situation in which we need to say, in this case, is the board interpreting Ovasquez itself in an unreasonable way, or is it finding a rigidity in the Ovasquez decision that the CSPA doesn't actually authorize, that goes beyond what Congress was trying to do. He is attempting to follow this, and he also has the disadvantage of being in jail. And I think it's a little insouciant for the government to say, oh, well, just because he's in jail doesn't mean he can't pursue his immigration matter.
Well, I mean, I don't, it doesn't make a difference in this case anyway, whether he was incarcerated or sitting at home, because the bottom line is he was unaware of the deadline. Neither he nor his father knew about the deadline. So whether he was incarcerated, you know, when the NTA was filed or when he was served, the fact of the matter is he was unaware of it.
Well, and this is where I go back to the other point. There's the 2005 there's the 2001 I-130, which is the one that the government decided was abandoned. Then there's the 2005 I-130, which is approved in 2009. But then when he asks, when he submits his FOIA request, he gets documents only about the 2001 petition, which was the supposedly abandoned one, indicates denied due to abandonment. The government's response says nothing about his approved 2005 petition, and it doesn't tell him that he has only a few months left to apply based on the approved petition. That's the mix-up that's really almost intolerable here. You say, well, he didn't know, you know, but you respond to the FOIA request, you don't even know that the 2005 petition is out there. And it's approved. He has an approved petition. It's not the 2001 petition that's approved.
No, Your Honor, if I may, the only way he would have been eligible for adjustment is under 245I. So the FOIA request was to find out about whether or not he had filed an I-130 before the April 30th, 2001 deadline, which he had. The April 26, 2001 I-130, because of that filing and because it was not a frivolous finding, they were father and son, et cetera, even though it had been abandoned, it had been filed and would have been approvable. That's what made the 2005 I-130 even in the ballpark. He was able to grandfather
it. But it is
in.
Approved, right.
Oh, yes.
Maybe with the...
There's no indication that he didn't know that his I-130 had been approved. It was
the 1 year dates from the 2009.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. It's when his visa becomes available.
Oh, right. His visa number pops up, and then he has a year. But the point is that's deriving from the 2009 approval. He doesn't have any visa number based on the 2001.
No, it's right. It's the petitioner's or applicant's responsibilities to stay on. It's their
benefit. And he tries to do
benefit.
It. He files the FOIA request, and nobody tells him anything. The government's like playing hide the ball here.
Well, Your Honor,
it's like any way we can decide to deny this, we'll find.
Was represented by counsel, and by September 2011, when they got the FOIA request back from the previous I-130, so they knew that he was, you know, in the ballpark to play, essentially, that's when
that's not what the FOIA request asked for. It asked for all I-130 applications, and the government sends him one only about the 2001 application. I guess what I'm going toward is whether the particular mix-ups in this man's case amount to the kind of extraordinary circumstances that even the board recognizes in O'Vasquez. Because I would hope anyway that the board usually, or the DHS, whoever it is who's running the show, actually usually keeps people straight. Now, maybe that's not right, but I would hope that this is an extraordinary circumstance where he asks for all, he's only told about one, and because he's not told about the one that's approved, he doesn't know that this clock is ticking based on the approved visa number.
Well, I think there could possibly be extraordinary circumstances in this case, but I don't think it's the mix-ups that Your Honor's referring to. I don't believe that there were mix-ups.
Let's talk about how this might apply here. Suppose in this case the FOIA request had been made let's say 2 months before the 1 year expires, okay? And the response comes back, let's say it's a complete response, but it comes back 13 months. That is 3 months later, a month after the 1 year limit has expired. How would we apply Ovezquez in that case?
Again, I think
he's seeking information that would seem to be essential to prepare the application.
You know, these visas, especially in this case,
question is, would the FOIA request be enough to show that he sought to acquire within the 1 year? It's really a very straightforward question.
No, it would not be enough.
Why not?
We would say that simply doing things such that the agency that's required to make the adjudication, in this case DHS, would have no way of knowing just because someone has sought a FOIA request that they're eligible to adjust within this year.
Right. Well, but why does that matter? I mean, the focus here is, it seems to be quite reasonably, on something objective. Sitting at home thinking about applying is not enough. I suspect that just trying to earn money to pay a lawyer to apply is not enough, etc. Talking to a lawyer is probably not enough. The board itself tells us going to a lawyer, filling out the application, where your agency would not know about it at all, is enough, right? That's in Ovezquez.
Well, I think what Ovezquez says is if someone had filled out an application and it was
get to us because of circumstances beyond the petitioner's control, right?
Correct.
So knowledge of the agency is not necessarily the be-all and end-all, right?
If there's an extraordinary circumstance that can be shown that was beyond the alien's control, yes, that's correct.
You're looking for actual activity, objective indications of an intent to pursue this, right?
Yes, but it's the filing is sort of the bright line, the benchmark. It's the standard from which they then move.
Is that Ovezquez does not create a rigid rule of filing.
Exactly.
And so that takes us to what short of filing, which circumstances are going to be enough? And even the board has recognized that there are some.
Oh, absolutely.
It might not know, or DHS might know anything about the fact that this person is going to file, but because of circumstances beyond its control, it didn't get there in time. And it's going to be okay under Ovezquez.
Yes. I mean, the board gave immigration judges and boards to follow the flexibility to look at cases individually. That it isn't, yes, we have this sort of bright line standard, sort of the gold standard of sought to acquire is filing. But the analysis wouldn't end there. If there were circumstances that, for instance, maybe even in this particular case where, well, should he have filed with USCIS or should he have filed with DHS? Well, maybe if there had been a completed application ready to go and maybe had been filed with CIS but they rejected it for some reason, there may have been, say, either one, you know, a technical glitch in, well, which agency, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing, or even an extraordinary circumstance. So I think there's enough flexibility, reasonableness, if you will, built into Ovezquez's analysis to cover that kind of situation. And the court does nothing further. Any further questions?
No.
Thank you very much.
Anything further, Mr. Khalil?
So just a few points that counsel brought up. Extraordinary circumstances. Let's assume that the interpretation of Ovezquez is reasonable. Were there extraordinary circumstances here? I think so. In the board's decision in 2009, precedential decision, matter of EVRA, detention or incarceration by the alien is through no fault of the alien. It's an extraordinary circumstance anyway. But yet, in our case, they decided that it wasn't an extraordinary circumstance. Moreover,
isn't that because he was out for 11 months up until then? So 11 months of the 12, he wasn't incarcerated?
He was not. That's true. However, that one-year window is still available to him, even if it's one day. He was put in custody at least at DuPage County Jail, in January of 2012.
What about the extraordinary circumstances that Judge Wood presents regarding this FOIA and what information you received?
Well, like counsel indicated, the FOIA was to allow him to see if he can apply for adjustment. And it did. There was a grandfathering petition, the first I-130. Now, the 2005 one was the one we used for the F2A category because it was pending for so long, so we calculated his Child Status Protection Act age at under 21, maybe 19. So he did apply. He did apply for adjustment of status. At least the FOIA is not an adjustment application, no, but it is some sort of signal to whatever adjudicating agency here was DHS that, hey, I'm looking forward to adjust my status. I want to find out if I can adjust my status.
Which office at DHS was the FOIA submitted to?
Citizenship and Immigration Services.
Yeah, yes.
So a part of DHS. But like the government's attorney says, they're very big. Right hand doesn't talk to the left hand. So outside of the 1 year, barely 2 months after, in May of 2012, he did file his application while he was incarcerated per the judge's order. Immigration Judge Fujimoto. Now, a lot of the unpublished decisions, and in fact, at Tovar's site, I think it was a matter of Kim, it was almost an identical situation. The respondent there, the petitioner here, had filed his adjustment application while in removal proceedings, and it was only 2 months after the 1 year period expired. So it was about 14 months. This is exactly what happened with Jorge, the petitioner here. So I still think, even if the court believes that this is a reasonable interpretation, that he falls under the exceptional circumstances requirement, or the extraordinary circumstances requirements. And this stuff is not cheap. This is another thing that the government, you know, hasn't pointed out. His adjustment application cost upwards of $2,500. He had the $1,000 penalty. He had the $1,070 I-45 adjustment application. And we knew he needed a waiver application for the cannabis conviction, which is another $585 currently. So that's $2,500 that he was stuck with. So that could have been another reason why he didn't file. He didn't have the money.
Okay. Well, we thank you for your presentation. Thanks to the government as well. We'll take the case under advisement.